Hello, and welcome to Program Progeny. How are you, Dad?
Hi, Tallulah. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. How is... You're at Real World, aren't you?
We are. I'm currently sat in the bedroom where I've been staying for the last week. Today's our last day. Mike's currently recording some drums with Ian. But we've had a really good week. We did quite a lot, actually. In fact, on the first day, Mike said, we did more in that one day than we normally do in a week at Racket. So
really?
That was good. We went through we did like bits for three different songs. It was like, right, that's done, next. You know, it was kind of really, really good.
What does the day-to-day actually look like there? Like, what time do you get up?
Been waking up so early, like 5:30, 6 o'clock. I think it's because this place, there's like windows at the top that don't cut the light
out.
That's
not required that you get up that early.
No. We don't usually start about 10 or 11. So after breakfast, everybody wanders over to the studio and then we'll just, Mike will probably tell us the day before what we're going to be doing so that we've got some warning. So if we want to do any prep for it, you know, learning parts or refreshing memories or getting sounds, that sort of thing. And then we'd say, pick a song. And let's say there's a song that we've done a recording of at the Racket and it's been worked on, but it kind of just cuts off at the end because we didn't plan it, you know. And then we say, well, this could have a guitar solo. So let's play the second part, you know, the second half of the song and continue on and let Steve just solo over the top for like 10 minutes. And then we can choose the best bits, you know, and cut, you know, edit the song down to a normal length. So we did some of that sort of thing. Steve's been on fire, actually, with his playing. He's been really good. So I think it's going to be good. I got the chance to play the real Hammond organ because I sold mine back in 1990-something. It's been fun. It's been really good. Very productive.
What time do you finish?
So we'd stop for lunch at about 1 for like half an hour and then carry on through till dinner, which is about 7. And then usually have a glass of wine with dinner if you're one of the band members that drinks wine.
Which is, how many of you drink wine? How many of you drink?
Me, Steve and Steve, Rothers and H and me. Mike does like wine, but not when he's working. And then we go back in the studio and do a jam. One night we did this percussion thing. There's a track where it's kind of got like this kind of Latin-y percussion thing going on. And Mike said, it'd be great if we had like a whole, you know, crowd of people playing all this percussion. So the assistant engineer got out this huge box of percussion instruments and we all played them and recorded it. So it's meant to be kind of loose sounding and it was fairly loose sounding. So that was fun. but yeah, it's been good. So yeah, usually after dinner, it's more of a, you know, just have a bit of fun, do a jam, try something, you know, off the wall rather than serious work, you know. And then we usually finish about 9:30, and then everybody's been going to bed really early. It's like, I can remember when we used to be at the studio years ago, we'd stop work and then we'd start partying, you know.
Yeah,
and now it's, like,
when did that bed stop by happening?
10 Oh, long time ago. Well, you know, when we work at the Racket Club, everybody's driving, so nobody's drinking. But these days, I mean, literally, I was in bed at 10 o'clock most nights.
So, why do you go to Real World?
Because it's quite inspiring. I'm going to show you quickly. So just leave this room. I don't know if you can see okay. So this is the house where we stay, which is...
Oh, it's nice.
It is a nice house, yeah. It's a big kind of farmhouse. I'm going to tell me that you can see everything okay.
Yeah, I can see.
So cool. Just going downstairs, and then there's a big sort of dining area here, and we've got a chef that makes really good food. Yes, this is where we eat.
Yeah,
here.
I was going to ask what you eat. What do you eat?
There's a French chef, and he's really good, called Jerome. Okay. And this is the outside. So there's like a seating area here. Peter Gabriel's private studio is hidden in the bushes over there. and that's the actual studio. And we sort of, we met Peter Gabriel for the first time the other day. He came in and said hello, which was really nice. I was like a starstruck kid. I was just grinning, you know. Sorry, it's quite noisy here because there's like a waterfall.
Yeah, you're screaming.
Yeah, and then this is the actual studio. Ian's in there playing. Yeah. Oh. He's busy recording, so I'm trying to be quiet. And there's another studio through here, which is where we don't use it for much, but there's a nice piano in here that we use for recording sometimes. And I think they're doing some filming in here. Well, they were. Tim is with us. Tim Sidwell, and there's the piano and some microphones for singing.
Oh, cool.
So there you go. And there's Pete. I am. Right. So that's real world.
Yeah, you start with talking about how you got a call from Travis's manager asking you to play keyboards for them at the Isle of Wight Festival.
Yeah, that was, and I was in France. Remember the house in France? Well, of course you
yeah.
do. It was being renovated, and I was trying to pick some tiles to go on the kitchen floor. And I got a phone call from Ian McAndrew, who managed Travis at the time. And basically he was like, do you want to do the gig? And I'm like, well, how long have I got? And he said, I'll give you 15 minutes to decide. So I phoned Adam Wakeman, just to
is that Rick
check with him.
Wakeman's son?
Yes. Yeah, and I had no idea, because I kind of knew Travis's stuff as a listener, but I didn't listen to it with a view just saying, oh, you know, what are the keyboards like? It was because they're more of a
guitar
band
anyway.
They're very different.
They're very different to Marillion.
Yeah, and there's not a huge amount of keyboards on their songs, to be honest. It's just a few key things that you need, you know, like Why Does It Always Rain On You, their big hit, has got strings on it, and, you know, there's a few piano-type stuff, and... But anyway, Adam was like, yeah, just do it. It's easy. Don't worry. He said, I'll pop round and I'll show you how it goes. You know, I can give you the sounds that I used and I'll give you some notes. And I said, great. So when I got home, I went round to see Adam and we kind of went through each song that we'd like likely to play. And he kind of told me what he does. And then he'd write the notes for each song. This is what you do in this song. And then he'd have a song and he'd just put drink beer. Because there's nothing to do in this song. But there was probably about five songs in the set where he'd written drink beer. I would have been completely drunk by the end of it if I followed his instructions. But...
that would have been bad. How was it different to Marillion?
Very different, because I was there very much the hired hand, you know. You know, the hired musician rather than one of the band, you know.
But
and
did you
whilst
feel
they were
like...
really friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a, well, especially, I don't know, I got the feeling from Fran, the singer, Fran Healy, that he kind of saw me like that. That's how it felt to me. I think I was wrong because he was just a bit more standoffish than the rest of them. He was nice, he was friendly and everything, but I just felt like, you know, I was like, I don't know.
An intruder.
You know, I just had that feeling. Well, no, just that I was being paid to do a job and that was it. You know, we weren't friends sort of thing, you know. But the reason why I think I was wrong about that was because, you know, probably a year or two later, he was living in Berlin and we were playing there and I messaged him and he said, oh, come round. And I went round and hung out with him for half a day. And he was really friendly and really nice. And I just thought, okay, so
maybe
I
he's
just
got
serious
the
wrong impression.
When it works.
I was, yeah, and that may be the case. Maybe he didn't want to be too friendly in case he had to fire me or in case he had to kind of say, look, you're doing this wrong or whatever, you know, so maybe he was just being professional.
Was he friendlier with the other bandmate members than you, was it?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Of course. They grew up together, you know, they're all from Glasgow. But, yeah, the rest of them were really nice, Andy, Dougie and Neil, very friendly. And
How was it different to Marillion? How it was like there?
Well, for a start, when we did the Isle of Wight gig, we flew there in a helicopter, you know. So it was like, wow, this is big time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I did in a helicopter once with Meridian back in the 80s.
Are they more successful than Meridian Trust?
In the UK. Right. In the UK, they're probably bigger than we were with, you know, Kaylee. They had a few big singles.
No, they are. I like them. They're a good band.
Yeah. But so they were playing, you know, headlining the Isle of Wight Festival, Tea in the Park. I can't remember the other ones that we did. So it started off as one gig. That's what I was being hired to do. And then it was like, okay, we need to do a warm-up gig. And then we've got Tea in the Park and we've got, you know, there was a bunch of them. So it was that, which I liked. It was good. Yeah. Can't remember how much they paid me now, but it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't doing it for the money.
No.
Really.
You said that audience were different.
Yeah, I kind of realised how appreciative the Marillion audience is by comparison. You know,
but you were playing festivals, so.
Yeah, but even at, I'm talking more about the gig that we did, I think it was in, where was it, like Norwich or somewhere. We did this little club gig, you know, like 1,000 people, as a warm-up. And so it was their audience, and it would be their hardcore audience. And I felt like the enthusiasm was there, but mainly at the very end when they played Why Does It Always Rain On Me. You know, it didn't feel like the audience were as into it as our audience is.
Yeah. I think that is the thing with the band. More of a
casual audience, yeah. Because they had hit singles, I think people go and see them because, they see that they're playing and they go, oh, I know that band. I know one or two songs. And that's kind of as far as it goes.
Yeah, it's a bit like Scouting for Girls or something. They are quite a like festival-y band. I don't mean that in a mean way, but you see them headlining a lot of stuff and because they do have, everyone knows their hits.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think we probably had a bit of that back in the 80s when we were playing these big arenas after the success of Misplaced Childhood. There would be a, you know, a certain percentage of casual listeners that were just coming because they knew Kaylee or Lavender or whatever. Mm. So I can see it. Mm. You know.
But your audience tend to know most of your songs.
Now, I think, yeah, it's like if people are still following us now, they it's because they really like the band. That's how it seems. Because, you know, you do tend to have people that will buy one album, see you on one tour, and then move on, you know? But people that get into Marillion, they stay with us for life.
Steve, and Pete, I want to say? Or
yeah, Steve.
We're
yeah,
doing
it was,
Los
it was Steve
Trios Marillios.
Los Trios Marillios. Yeah. I don't know whose idea it was to call it Los Trios. That was something that started a little while before. It was one of those things where we'd get asked to do a gig and we'd be like, it's not really worth sending the whole band and, you know, taking a truck. But it would be nice to go there. It would be nice to do it. Mm. And that kind of format of doing acoustic. We did the Less Is More album around about 2009, which was kind of us all playing acoustic instruments and very sort of pared down setup. But yeah, it was just the, you know, it's two guitars,
where
and a singer, that
America?
Sort of thing. Just around, I wasn't there, but I remember they played in this, mainly sort of East Coast and, you know, Philadelphia, places like that.
And then Delilah was born, my sister.
Yeah, your little sister.
Yeah.
You were no longer an only child.
I know, I was good at being an only child, I think.
Oh, you were good at being spoiled. Yeah. You enjoyed it.
And then you moved to Uffington and you bought our big house in Uffington. And Mum was angry that people would attribute that house to your success.
People always, regardless of where I lived, people always assume that, you know, once they hear that you're in Marillion, or they used to, maybe not so much now, would think that you were wealthy. They would think that you'd made loads of money, you know.
You're hardly making not a lot of money. Like, you know, you're doing well.
As I've been through a number of lean years and a divorce,
You weren't very financially savvy. You could have had more money than you.
I wasn't very financially secure, no, and I didn't have a big house in the country until me and your mum bought one mostly with her money. So, and then people would come and they'd drive up the driveway and they'd see this big house and they'd be like, oh, you know, you're doing well. So, you know, it's kind of, they just assumed
that it was you.
That it was my money, yeah. And so your mum would be kind of miffed about that.
I don't blame her.
She would make a point of just, but even if nobody said anything, she would make a point of telling people it was her money that bought the house.
Welcome. You know. I paid for it.
Exactly. She did that whole, Daily Mail. Oh, let's get the Daily Mail to do a piece on well,
no, they were doing a piece on women who make more than their husbands. And
your mum volunteered herself as a case study. Right, and me, yeah. But I wasn't bothered, you know.
No, yeah, you said in the book it didn't make you feel emasculated. Is that the complete truth?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, I know some men feel like they're worthless if their wives are earning more than them and all this sort of thing. But I've had it both ways, you know, where I've been the only breadwinner, where I've been the one that was earning the least, and I've been, you know, equal. So it's not, it doesn't really make any difference. I think if you're serious about the relationship that you're in, then it shouldn't matter, you know?
No.
It's like you know, if you're both contributing to the relationship in whatever ways you can, then I think that's...
I liked it because I think it really, it didn't give me this like idea of gender norms. Like I didn't grow up thinking that it was normal for the men to make more money.
Yeah, and it's not that unusual. I mean, I know it's less usual.
I think it was
usual,
when I was in primary school. Like
there were some dads that were stay-at-home dads and the mothers were out working. I mean, actually not earning money dads, I mean.
When I was at school.
Yeah. So I think it's... Why shouldn't it be like that?
I think it's great.
Yeah. You know, it's just a case of if one partner in a relationship is earning way more than the other and the other one can look after the kids while the first one goes out and earns the money, what's wrong with that? If it was the other way around, nobody would say anything.
Yeah, that's no, they wouldn't. But that said, we're talking about the money thing. Marillion were actually doing quite well financially, you did say. And you didn't know whether to do a pre-order.
From the mid-2000s, certainly from Marbles onwards, things, I'd say we were doing quite well, but we were back on a steady income and everything was much better. Mm. You know, we weren't struggling to find money for the next 3 months, that sort of thing, which was what the 90s were like, you know. So, yeah, Ian has always done a great job with the money. He's very good at planning ahead, paying the bills and making sure that, you know, it's all good. He's quite responsible, shall we say.
Yeah. But you were like, I don't know whether to do a pre-order, and not realising how much that meant to the fans, actually.
Yeah, I, because it was my idea to do the pre-order, I suppose I felt like once we'd done Marbles, and we'd raised enough money to do all the promotion and be financially secure that we didn't feel like we had to do another pre-order in order to survive till the next album was out. I think the way I described it was, it's a bit like when a friend helps you out by lending you some money, then you pay them back and everything's fine and you don't need to borrow money anymore. Mm. You don't then go to them and say, oh, can you lend us some money anyway, you know?
Yeah.
And that was probably the wrong way to look at it, because...
They're not lending you money, though, are they?
Well, in a sense, they are, because they're giving us the money. Yeah, but that's not the way to look at it.
No.
Because whilst that is that's the financial transaction, if you like, what else is going on?
They're more investing in you, I'd say, rather than lending.
Exactly, and being involved and being part of it. I think I didn't think about it like that. It's like, we're supporting you. We're doing this because we want to see the next Marillion album come out. We want to be part of it. Not in the sense that we want to control it or or contribute to it, you know, creatively, but just to be part of it. And also the whole special edition, the anticipation, the pre-order, knowing that there's a new Marillion album coming and they've put their money down and now it's like, oh, countdown to the new album. All of that is quite exciting.
Mm.
And I hadn't really considered how important that was.
Mm.
So when we did it, when I persuaded everybody to not do a pre-order, the Somewhere Else album was kind of not as eagerly anticipated. And then when it did come out, it wasn't as liked either. We'd kind of gone through that thing.
Yeah, you shit on this album a lot in this chapter. Particularly the song Most Toys.
Yeah, because it's terrible.
Yeah, really good.
Have you listened to it?
Yeah, I listened to it. It's really crap. It's so repetitive.
As I said, it's like it's less than 3 minutes long and it still outstays its welcome, right? Yeah, that wouldn't happen now. That's the great thing. We've gone through a process, a learning process, and the culmination of that is where we're at now, where it's taken us like 4 years to write an album. We haven't been working on it continuously, but we've literally, you know, the amount of jams, the amount of musical ideas that have been distilled down to these 11 songs that are still going to be culled further to finally end up with an album that's everybody's happy with and nobody goes, oh, I don't like that song.
Yeah.
You know, because if Mike hears a whiff of I don't like that song, or even if he thinks you're not sure about it, he's like, right, forget it, we'll do something else.
Really?
He's so militant on that, you know.
Why?
So because he doesn't want to end up in another situation like happened with the EP that never happened, the four songs that we recorded. The first thing we did with Mike after Marbles, we did four songs, Real Tears for Sale, Circular Ride, Say the Word, which I don't know if it's ever seen the light of day. It probably has somehow. And I can't remember the fourth one. And the idea was we were going to do like a little EP. And then Ian said, that song, Say the World. He said, every time I hear it, I want to throw up. And once Mike got wind of that, he was so upset. You know, he took it very personally. And then he was almost ready to quit. He was like,
oh, really?
Because we'd worked on it and he'd invested in it and he'd kind of followed it through to the end and got to the point where it was finished. And then somebody says, ah, I don't like that. Not I don't like that. It makes me want to throw up. It's kind of very...
I can't lie, this, you know, this chapter did make me feel quite bad for Mike. Like, his job's not easy, it sounds like.
And then there was the whole thing where he mixed most of Marbles because Dave was so slow. And Dave was working on the Whoppers and he gave Mike more and more of it to mix. And Mike did a great job, and which is probably why Dave kept giving him stuff to mix. Mm. But then I think Mike felt like, okay, I can do that. I've done that sort of mixing loads of times. Let's be more adventurous with the next album, you know? So he kind of approached it with a more raw sound and I feel like maybe some of the songs aren't quite as good as what we've done in the past. And then he made the mistake of reading what people said about it online, you know, and people can be so cruel.
Mm. Yeah, you said his confidence was really...
Yeah, there was a lot of negative stuff said about Mike's production. They blamed him for things that weren't his fault, really, because, you know, he didn't write the songs. I'm just looking at the track listing for Somewhere Else now because I had to remind myself of everything that was on it. And it wasn't our best album, I'll just say that.
Mm.
The song Somewhere Else is really good. In fact, that if you remember, your mum and mine's bedroom in... that we had in Marcham, was the wallpaper was gold. Sounds a bit Trump. Gold wall.
Yeah.
And there was like an Egyptian, there was an Egyptian papyrus that we brought back from Egypt, a big thing on the wall of one of the tombs, you know. And Steve H had some relationship problem and was basically being kicked out of his house. Or being asked to go somewhere else. And I said, you can use our house because we're not going to be there for like the next couple of weeks. And he slept in our bedroom. And the lyric from the song Somewhere Else, he basically describes it. So he sings, woke up in a spaceship of shimmering gold. Tutankhamun sleeping should have left him alone. Floating around in Orion, arrow pointing to heaven. Because there was the stars and stuff in the... So basically, that was the inspiration, our bedroom.
That's so funny.
In March, and was the inspiration for that part of the lyric. Anyway, that track I think is good, but there are a few, like Most Toys and See It Like a Baby, I never liked either.
Yeah, you said that.
The Other Half Is Okay, but A Voice from the Past is a good song. Yeah, and I remember there was another song, Last Century for a Man, that we wrote that first, and we all loved it. We thought it was great.
Mm.
And now when you listen to it, I think it just goes on way too long. Mm. You know, it's got something good about it, but it's just something that we wouldn't do now, you know. The quality control in the band has got to the point where we would never allow most of those songs on Somewhere Else to appear in the form that they're in on that album.
Which album would you say that the quality, that's when the quality control started getting better?
After Mike's getting completely beaten up by the whole process and feeling like he didn't want to be in this position again where somebody hated something after it was all finished, he just said, right, everybody has to be honest. We're not going to work on anything unless everybody likes it. So he's constantly checking that everybody's happy and everybody likes things. And that's gradually grown up. So the next album that we did after that, maybe we should talk about that later, but that's... So that whole people not liking things and, you know, came to a real head at the end of this chapter. We're not doing the end of this chapter. So we'll talk about the rest of it.
That's
next time.
Big argument.
Yes, exactly.
But I just wanted to, because you said that Mike became quite like actively involved in the writing and recording. And you said that you didn't really hone this properly until 3 albums later, which was Sounds That Can't Be Made. And he changed tack after he got all that criticism and wanted to pursue every musical idea to its natural conclusion and then leave the decision to you for what made it onto the album. So you were probably doing a lot more work, right?
Yeah, well, I suppose the thing is, it's evolved since then. The way we work now, again, has kind of developed from that. But yeah, I think he was less expectant that everything we would work on would get finished and be on the next album type thing.
Right.
You know? I think he accepted that things, you know, we would develop an idea and then discard it, you know, not finish it. And of course, we'll have hundreds and hundreds of jams, and out of those hundreds and hundreds of jams, we'll select a few that we get really excited about. So it's a much slower process, but it's a different way of working.
Mm.
But I think it's the reason why we're still able to make, you know, the last 2 albums were really good comparatively to the rest of the catalogue. And this one, I think, is going to be really good too.
Hmm.
In fact, I think it might be in some ways better, more focused.
Your best.
That's hard to say, isn't it?
Yeah, again.
But I'm excited about it.
Can I ask one more question about this Most Toys song?
Go on.
Who? How did it get on the album then? Who liked it?
I think Steve H, Steve Rothery, Pete. I don't know if Ian liked
everyone.
It. Mike. Yeah, they kind of all thought it was, you know, it's us being young again, you know.
Jude's born then.
Jude was born, yes.
You nearly delivered him.
Yes. It was all a bit sudden. 1 minute. Everything was normal, the next minute your mum was having a baby. I remember
the drive to school was about 30 minutes. I remember leaving for school, mum was going into labour, and I got to school.
Oh, you were at the manor school weren't you?
I got to school and I got there and they were like, you can go home now, you have a baby brother. And then I came back home. So I was thrilled. I was so happy because I got to miss the day of school.
But yeah, literally, the two midwives turned up like less than 5 minutes.
She was in labour for 40 minutes, I think, is what she said.
Yeah. It was really, really quick. And I was kind of a bit disappointed because I kind of would have been like, hey, I nice. Delivered you, Jude, you know?
Yeah. Was the plan to go to hospital, but it was just too quick?
No. No, the plan was a home birth with a birthing pool and all that. But barely got the bloody thing inflated with a bit of water in it before it was all over.
God.
So, yeah, after Jude, because Jude was not planned, and not that I'm saying it was a bad idea to have Jude, because obviously Jude's great.
Yeah, I'm glad you had him.
It's a fantastic, fantastic addition to our family. But,
yeah, it was great.
But I just thought, you know what? I think it's time to put an end to this.
Yeah, you don't want to be having kids in your 50s.
That's pretty much why what I decided. I didn't want to be so old, you know, when they were growing up. So without telling your mum, I just went off and had the snip.
Why didn't you tell her?
I might have told her I was going to do it, but no, because she wasn't keen. She didn't want me to do it. So
what? Because she wanted another baby.
Yeah. So I went to the doctor and had the snip. And then Twitter was like quite a new thing at that point. So I tweeted about it. And that really didn't go down too well, actually.
That's awful.
I was.
You told the world before telling mum.
No. I think I told her, but she wasn't happy about me tweeting about it. But
what did you tweet?
I can't remember now. I actually deleted my entire Twitter account because I tweeted quite a few things I shouldn't have tweeted. Once there was a guy that died outside a restaurant. And his body was on the ground outside. So I was with the band and we were kind of upstairs in this upstairs room. And you could see like there was a bin bag covering this, but his arm was sticking out, you know. And I took a picture and posted it on Twitter and said, I hope he didn't eat at this restaurant, you know, like, which is not really very funny. It's making me laugh now, but everybody was like horrified. I'm like, oh, have I gone a bit too far? Maybe I should delete that. So not long after that, I actually deleted my Twitter account because I decided it was too dangerous in my hands.
I never knew that. So, oh my God, you're so lucky you're not a social pariah. That's really cancelable.
Well, you couldn't see the guy's face.
Still.
Oh, well.
That is bad. I'm keeping that in. That is really bad.
Give me into a social pariah. I didn't know that.
I thought you deleted Twitter because Elon Musk bought it.
No, so what I did, I deleted all my previous posts.
Oh.
And then started again with kind of a bit more grown up, you know, a bit more sensible. And then after Elon Musk bought it, then I actually deleted the account, yeah.
What else did you tweet that was bad?
Ah, stuff. I can't remember that. I
can't believe that's ridiculous. That's crazy. I never knew that. Jesus.
Let's stop there then. We'll snip the podcast at the snip and call it a day.
Yeah. Great.
Before we go, I just wanted to say I had a message, or we've had some nice messages from people, and a few new people joining. We had a message from Gary Johnson who asked, will we be doing any meetups in the forthcoming tour? In fact, I think he mentioned Portsmouth or Southampton or somewhere on the south coast that we're playing. I don't have the list in front of me. The answer is yes. I'm going to try and do one in everywhere, at the risk of boring people, and Tallulah should try and join me at least one or two of them.
I'll be there in London or Pompeii.
We could do one, yeah. But yeah, the idea is let's do as many as possible. I'm not promising that I'm going to do every single day because things could get in the way. But that would be nice. It'd be great to meet as many people as possible. So the answer to that is yes, but I will confirm where and when usually the day before or the day of the gig or whatever. You know, we'll just keep an eye on the Patreon message board, our chats on Patreon, to find out where and when and all that. So we've got 10 new members since last time, which is fantastic. I'll start at the bottom of the list. Chaz McKenzie. Chaz, hi. And we've got Nick, no surname. And we've got Susan Goodbrand, Peter Flood, Bob Kelly, spelt with an EY, and Alistair Kells, Patient Guitar, which is actually Chris. Hi, Chris. Thank you. James Espinosa, and Sherman, and Al. Thank you all thank very you. Much. Welcome aboard the crazy podcast. Oh, I'm going to be publishing the Marillion quiz soon. I've been working on that. It's fiendishly hard, but we're going to have for members only, we'll have a Marillion quiz, online quiz that people can try.
You can't Google anything.
There's a timer. Okay. I've thought of everything. There's a timer, so you won't have time to Google stuff. But yeah, let me finish it first. I'm working on it. Okay. See you next time.
Thanks,
Lula.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
In September 2001, the Stranglers played a fan convention over two nights at Pontins Holiday Camp in Somerset. Lucy had been contemplating the idea of Marillion possibly trying something similar, so she asked Andy Rotherham, a long-standing friend of and occasional guitar tech for the band and keen Stranglers fan, to go along and check it out. Andy reported back that he believed the model could work for Marillion. The Stranglers convention was organised by the band's manager, Syl Wilcox, who Lucy knew from her EMI days. So she asked him to help organise a Marillion weekend in return for a percentage of the takings. The band were sceptical, and we told Lucy so. I was probably the most unsure, mainly because of the chosen venue. The British Holiday Camp was derided even in its 1960s heyday, and its reputation had not improved with the passage of time. If you haven't experienced one, imagine a series of breeze block buildings leading to a function room staffed with grinning staff pushing forced hilarity and entertainment down your throat, and a swimming pool populated with bobbing band-aid plasters, and imagine it all in an endless grey rain. That's Butlins, or Butlins in my mind's eye, in case Mr. Butlins decides to send in the lawyers. Pontins is a step down from that. I should add that I have never visited one, as my parents couldn't even afford that when we were kids. I joked with Lucy that if we sold more than 1,000 tickets, then I would eat a bowl of tripe. We sold all 1,650 tickets, but the tripe remains untouched. Even Lucy, the most enthusiastic advocate of the weekend idea, couldn't have predicted how successful they would become. Like crowdfunding, which grew into a multi-billion worldwide industry and spawned numerous companies and copycat projects, the Marillion weekend has changed our lives. Every 2 years, we devote 4 months to preparing for the weekends in multiple countries, 5 in 2019 and possibly 6 in 2022. In 2007, we moved the main weekend to the Netherlands. There is nothing quite like the atmosphere of Centre Parks at Port Zeeland. Fans come from all over the world to be part of it. It has grown into something much more than three Marillion gigs set over a weekend. It's a party of reunited friends. It's a music festival. It's a family holiday. It's a weekend piss-up, depending on your personal preferences. In truth, it's all of these things and more. It's also a lot of hard work, worry and stress before it happens. But the payoff is that it's equally rewarding and magical too. Plus, it brings in enough money to enable us to spend more time in the studio between albums and tours, getting the next record ready. I will always be grateful to our fans for making this possible, and Lucy for pushing past my cynicism and dragging us through those holiday camp gates that first time at Pontins Breen Sands in Burnham-on-Sea in April 2002. The format of the weekends was set from the start, with the decision to play Brave in its entirety. We really do test our fans. As I said earlier, Brave, like lunch, is best consumed in one sitting. When we first performed it live, the audience hadn't even heard the album. I can still recall those quizzical faces looking confusedly upwards at us. Over the intervening years, many people have grown to love that album, but regretted never seeing it played in its entirety. We thought it would be a good draw to announce that we were playing it again as a special one-off for the weekend. That set the mould for every subsequent weekend, where we would elect to play one album in its entirety on the Friday night. We also wanted to make the Saturday night something special, and have tried several ideas over the years. People say there are no stupid questions, but they don't say that about ideas, though, and there's a reason for that. Over the years, it's been a pet project of mine to come up with a different theme for the Saturday night. For the debut Marillion weekend at the aforementioned Pontins in April 2002, my great idea was Marillion Bingo. This involved randomly choosing numbered balls from a bucket, where we had to play the song that corresponded to the chosen ball. I'll be honest, I hadn't properly thought this through, because we had to learn and rehearse about 5 hours of material to compile a credible list of songs. Knowing how much we hate rehearsing, you can imagine how that went down. As Pete once remarked, I'd rather be worse than rehearse. There were a few dummy songs on the list too, not least Grendel. We had no intention of playing it, and consequently there was no corresponding ball in the bucket. In any event, the songs that came up randomly were mostly songs we usually play live, which made the whole thing appear to be rigged. What's more, three balls with a number for Grendel had been secretly added to the bucket by the crew in the hope that it would surface. Thankfully, the prog gods were smiling on us that night and Grendel remained languishing in the bucket. We quietly filed the Marillion Bingo away and moved on to the next thing. Something else we introduced that first weekend, and have repeated it ever since, was Swap the Band, where we invite members of the audience up to replace one of us for a song. Five members, five songs. There was some scepticism from certain quarters that this was not our brightest idea, so we indulged in a bit of damage limitation by mostly inviting people we knew. Rick Armstrong played guitar on 80 Days, Jan Hendrik Olm, the singer from Gazpacho, performed Afraid of Sunlight, and Phil Harrison played drums on Sugar Mice. I first met Phil in 1997 in San Francisco, where he was working for Sony PlayStation. He invited Rothers and me up to his office with the promise of some free swag, and we instantly struck up a friendship. We've been best friends ever since. With the financial pressure off, thanks to the pre-order and the weekends, 2 years passed as we worked away on our next album. We were in great shape and had a lot of material to choose from, and we brought Dave Megan back on board again to produce. This was something of a record for us, working with the same producer for four albums, an indication of the high regard we all held him in. This, sadly, would be the last time Dave would produce us. Not long after finishing Marbles, Dave quit producing full-time. And for once, it wasn't working with Marillion that drove a producer off the rails. With a growing family, in the Irish tradition, three kids and counting, he wanted something more stable, with less time away from home, and retrained as an electrician. A big loss to music and a sign of where things were heading generally, as the industry shrunk to half its size in the decade following the new millennium. We had no concrete plan for the sort of record we wanted to make, but almost in spite of ourselves, it grew into a double album. Dave didn't like to stifle creativity, so couldn't bring himself to abandon any of the half-formed songs we were working on. This unsurprisingly meant everything took a little longer, and Dave, like Boxer from Orwell's Animal Farm, began working harder than ever. His single-minded dedication to getting the job done probably had a lot to do with his decision to quit producing altogether. Something had to give. Like most double albums, it could be said there are a few fillers on the record, but it's hard to argue with the depth of material in songs like Invisible Man, Ocean Cloud, Fantastic Place and Neverland. Songs that are still greeted like old friends at our live shows. Somehow, and so unlike us, I know, we were running out of time with our tour approaching, so in order to get the mix done on time, Dave suggested asking Mike Hunter to work on a few tracks. Mike had quit Buckinghamshire for good after the Brave Tour, or so he thought, as he missed Liverpool and seeing his beloved Everton getting beaten most Saturdays. With Dave working in the control room, Mike set up the main studio with the task of mixing the four short Marbles sections, while Dave got on with the more substantial material like The Invisible Man and Ocean Cloud. We all enjoyed Mike's mixes, including Dave, so we asked Mike to mix a few more until Mike ended up mixing the majority of the album. With a double album on offer for the pre-order, we hiked the price up as high as we dared in order to create a war chest for the launch of the album to rival the sort of budget a major label might lavish on a release. They used a simple formula to decide how much to spend, £1 for every copy they expected to sell. With 18,000 pre-orders, we had about £300,000 to spend after clearing costs. We still needed to keep something to live on, but that meant we could give Marbles the push it deserved. The first tangible result of this was You're Gone charting at number 7. our best showing in the UK singles chart since Incomunicado. By 2004, single sales were in steep decline, so in terms of sales, it was a fraction of a 1980s hit, but it still garnered some attention. You'll recall my earlier point about there being no stupid question, but some pretty dumb ideas, so read on. We hired a digital marketing company, 1000 Heads, to help us reach a new fan base. Working with them, I helped to develop a competition we called Musical Mystery, congruent with the prevailing thought within the band that nobody who didn't already know our music would touch us with a shitty stick. The idea of the Musical Mystery competition was to introduce Marillion to a new audience by stealth. There was a cash prize of £4,000 for the winner, and the campaign cost us a cool £25,000 on top of that. The quiz was in 8 rounds, with the final 3 rounds consisting of sound clips from the yet-to-be-released Marbles album, with the participants having to guess the band. It certainly helped to bring some new fans on board, but it simply didn't reach enough people. The competition's participants numbered in the low thousands at best. We concluded that maybe this marketing lark isn't as easy as it looks, and we should stick to the day job, which in our case was getting out and playing to people. Between May and November 2004, we played nearly 70 gigs throughout Europe and North America. Not only could we start to feel the sun on our faces, now we were almost standing in the light.
Chapter 19. Big Mouth Strikes Again. I was caught in a reverie, torn between crushed beetroot and powder blue, when my phone burst into life. For those wondering if I was either trying to recapture my youth with hallucinogenic substances on the nearest golf course again, or debating my next stage outfit, who could forget my silver trousers and tie-dye top? God knows I've tried. But it was neither. It was early June 2005, and I was adulting, standing in a shop in the middle of France looking at tiles. Tiles, incidentally, which appeared to come in all the colours of the rainbow. It was like a giant packet of spilled Skittles, if Skittles came as ceramic squares. I was trying to decide what would look best on the kitchen floor of the holiday home we had recently bought with Angie's sister's family. I looked down and my phone was still ringing. It was Ian McAndrew, the manager of the band Travis. Apparently, Morrissey had pulled out of the Isle of Wight Festival at the last minute, and Travis was stepping in to replace him and needed a keyboard player. Ian said our mutual friend Phil Harrison had suggested me as a possible replacement for Adam Wakeman, who was the regular session player for Travis. Adam was unavailable. He had gone from Travis's bucolic The Man Who album and opted for the less understated Diary of a Madman instead, and headed off on tour with Ozzy Osbourne. I was unsure. I knew and I liked their album, but just how much? I asked how long I had to decide. 15 minutes, Ian replied. I hung up, called Adam, and asked how difficult the Travis gig was. He said it was easy and I should do it. He was right. Travis were a guitar band with minimal keyboards. No Keith Emerson-like histrionics here. Still, I was glad we had a warm-up gig in Norwich before the big festivals. It was now the Isle of Wight and Tea in the Park, a gargantuan Scottish festival. Travis were also invited to play at Live 8, but I had to turn it down because Marillion were booked to play the Bospop Festival in the Netherlands on the same day. Live 8 was only a few songs, but Adam happened to be available that day. I'm glad it was him and not me because the keyboards refused to work and they played on without him. Poor Adam. It was an interesting experience being in a different band for a few weeks, even as the hired hand. That said, Travis made me feel welcome and invited me to fly in their private helicopter to the Isle of Wight. Instead of flying straight back to London after the show, I opted to return by ferry the following day, and I'm glad I did. How many people can say they've been on a ferry with Brian Ferry, who was also on the bill, apart from all the other people who shared the boat home that day? One thing I did notice about Travis was that the audience reaction mirrored the band's music and therefore wasn't as intense as the Marillion crowd. So I was glad to return to the fold when it all came to an end. We're so very lucky in that regard. While I was off moonlighting with Travis, Rothers, Pete and H were experimenting with touring as a three-piece under the moniker of Los Trios Marillos. It was an inexpensive way to get back to North America following the revived interest caused by the Marbles album and tour. The full band closed the year with an early Christmas tour of Europe. This ensured that I was back home in plenty of time for the birth of my third daughter, Delilah, on the 20th of December. 2006 was a quiet year for Marillion, with only two summer festivals to play. Angie and I moved to a new and bigger house in Uffington, which came with a view of the famous white horse carved into a nearby hill. In case you're thinking that Marillion was suddenly in clover, I should say that, while things were certainly better than they'd been for several years, it was Angie's business that was booming. It annoyed her that people automatically assumed that we lived in a lavish home because of Marillion's success. Consequently, she wasted little time in telling anyone in earshot that it was mostly her money that paid for the house. Just to be sure she hadn't missed anyone, she even roped me into an interview with the Daily Mail for a feature highlighting women earning double their husband's wages. Not that I was emasculated in any way. Angie may have been earning more than me, and would casually drop it into any conversation the way a farmer scatters seeds, but I had a far more enjoyable job and saw a lot more of the children. I call that success. With two successful album pre-order campaigns behind us and the upturn in our fortunes, we had finally reached a point where we weren't having to scrabble around just to make ends meet. Remarkably, we even had some record royalties coming in from EMI and songwriting royalties from our publisher too. We weren't about to buy racehorses and start lighting our cigars with banknotes, but the combination of these royalties and the income from Racket Records, touring and merchandise, plus the steady hands of Mosley on the purse strings and Lucy at the helm, meant that the good ship Marillion was on a steady course and in calmer waters than it had been for years. Nobody questioned that we would do another pre-order for the next album, except me. Like a spectre at the feast, I said it didn't feel quite right if we didn't need the cash. It seemed like borrowing money from a friend when it wasn't needed. I persuaded the band and Lucy that if we didn't need to do it, then we shouldn't. Reader, I was wrong. Even though the pre-order concept had been my idea, I hadn't fully grasped the notion that for the fans, the pre-order was more than just a financial transaction. They enjoyed the special editions with the beautifully crafted books and artwork with their names printed alongside ours. Plus, they also liked being involved, being part of the journey Marillion were on. Eventually, we would take orders before the album release, but the absence of a proper pre-order caused disappointment in some quarters when Somewhere Else was released in April 2007. It wasn't just the fact that there was no special edition that dismayed people either. Sonically, and in terms of songwriting, Somewhere Else proved to be something of a challenge too. After finishing Marbles, Mike Hunter had returned to Liverpool, but we asked him to travel to Minehead with us for the third Marillion weekend in March 2005, as we needed someone to take charge of the sound recording for what would later become Marbles by the Sea. Much like many a seaside romance, one thing led to another, and before long, he was back working with us at Racket on the next album. He didn't want to leave Liverpool again, but was willing to be a weekly commuter, returning home at weekends. After such an intense writing and recording period with Marbles, we decided to engage in a shorter project and record an EP, or mini-album, with Mike producing. We had a few half-finished songs, but the four we settled on for the EP were Say the Word, Circular Ride, Real Tears for Sale, and Faith. Mike hadn't yet experienced the way we now work together, from the jamming through to the finished recording. He also hadn't realised that we don't all agree on what makes a good song, nor are we always open about what we think of the songs we are working on, behaviour that can be described as disquieting at best. This wasn't because we had decided to play mind games with Mike. It was just that experience had taught us all that sometimes the embryonic songs we love don't turn out so well, and that music which initially left us cold could go on and grow into band favourites. Nothing kills an unfinished composition quicker than one of the band dismissing it in the demo stages. As we're fond of saying, a song might be only one overdub away from being great. With that in mind, it came as something of a shock for Mike to learn rather late in the recording process that Ian hated Say the Word. I can't say I hated it, but I wasn't about to take it home and introduce it to my parents either. We were all a bit lukewarm on Real Tears for Sale and Circular Ride too, so we agreed to abandon the EP idea and start all over again. I think Mike felt that his role in Marbles, finishing Dave's work, was fairly restrictive. He was brought in to mix and he did a great job, but I remember him saying how easy it was and he could do it standing on his head, something I wish we had tested him on. Regardless, he did a great job. I got the impression that coming in to produce somewhere else meant that he wanted to challenge himself just that little bit more. Armed with the knowledge that it's hard to reach a consensus within the band, Mike worked with us to pursue every musical idea to its natural conclusion, then leave the decision as to what made the album for us to argue over at some later date. As Mike was now intimately involved in the writing and arranging of our songs, we had to learn to work together as a team. This process unfolded over the next three albums, and it wasn't until we got to Sounds That Can't Be Made some 5 years later that we were truly in sync and capable of working in a way that didn't lead to finished songs that made some of us frown. Throw a rock and you'll probably hit a Marillion fan who will agree with me when I say that Most Toys is a song only a mother could love. At under 3 minutes, it still manages to outstay its welcome. I'm still not sure what made the rest of the band and Mike want to record it, but my objections, some verbal and the occasional hand sign, were overruled. Somewhere Else had a harder-edged production than anything we had made previously. Consequently, Mike took something of a battering from the fans on the Marillion online forum. Crucially, he made the schoolboy error of reading what people were saying about the album, its production, and consequently him. People can be rather forthright from behind their keyboard, and Mike's confidence was pretty shaken by the comments, so much so that he started to wonder if he was really the right producer for Marillion. He took some persuading from us that he was. The woeful Most Toys aside, songs like See It Like a Baby and The Wound didn't exactly thrill us as a band either. There were a few others, especially True, Throw Me Out, Older Than Me, from the writing and recording sessions that hadn't even made the album cut. To mop up this unused material, we created a disc of also-rans called The Hard Shoulder to accompany the next album, Happiness is the Road. Not so much a double album, think of it more of a single record plus a bonus disc. Typically, we couldn't agree on which songs deserved to be on the main road and which should be shoved over onto the hard shoulder like a clapped-out Cortina. It's a bit unfair to call The Man from Planet Marzipan an also-ran, and Real Tears for Sale was rescued from the doomed EP sessions because Lucy kept pestering us to include it. We had now released 3 CDs worth of new songs in a scant 2 years. That was faster than when we were under the financial cosh of the late 1990s. It's unsurprising, then, that for some it was below par creatively. Though not all. There will always be a place in my heart for the songs Somewhere Else, This Train Is My Life, and Happiness Is the Road. But we needed balance and a new way of working that meant the weaker material could be addressed and jettisoned before we found ourselves making another Most Toys. I was confident that we knew what we were doing, and it was all eventually resolved before we recorded our next album, but not before the furore that almost broke the band up. In March 2007, we played our first Marillion weekend in Center Parks, Port Zeeland, in the Netherlands. This would prove to be so popular that we would return there every 2 years to sell out audiences until the COVID pandemic forced us to miss a year in 2021. We toured through April, May and June throughout Europe, and I was back home in plenty of time for the birth of my second son, Jude, on the 7th of September. He was nearly delivered single-handedly by me in the playroom of our house in Uffington, but the midwives arrived with 5 minutes to spare. If I'm honest, I was a bit disappointed they arrived in time. Dr. Kelly has a rather nice ring to it. Following the tradition established with Tallulah, both Jude and Delilah were also christened with 12 names. I have to admit that we were struggling for inspiration when it came to Delilah, but we dusted off some obscure relatives' names, the way Harrison Ford dusts off artifacts and human skulls in Indiana Jones, along with feminizing an uncle's name to make up the numbers. Although Jude wasn't exactly planned, and when I say not exactly planned, what I'm saying is he wasn't planned at all, he was a welcome and much-loved addition to our growing family. After Jude was born, I unilaterally decided to visit my local GP and get the snip. As I was already the father of 5 kids and 46 years old, I felt like I had done my bit for the human race. They would have carted me off to jail in China at the rate I was going. Besides, I think it's irresponsible to father a child when you've reached the stage in your life where each time you get up from a chair, you make an involuntary sound like air escaping from a tire. I was knocking on, and it was time to knock it off, as it were. The taps were duly turned off. With another album out in 2008, the band was back on the road in the autumn for just a month. Our touring schedule was being pared back due to a number of factors, not least because we weren't as successful as we once were. There were fewer places to play profitably. Plus, we all had young families now and more of a say in what we chose to do and not do. We didn't want to be on the road all the time. Also, my going on tour caused upset with Angie and had done almost from the beginning of our relationship. This issue only worsened as time went on. There were frequent arguments in the weeks leading up to a tour, including periodic breakups in our relationship just before I departed to go on tour or while I was away. When I eventually returned home, things would slowly return to normal until the next time I had to go away again. Two words, domestic bliss, or do I mean blitz?